Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. Of course, you know my smooth, melodic voice. I am Adam Lowther, and I'm joined by Curtis McGiffin and Jim Petrosky, as is most often the case. And so good to see you, Jim. Good to see you, Curtis.
Adam, I just want to clear that up because I was listening. I heard, I am Madam Lowther. Are you?
That's Madam what I Madam? Heard too. He's I Madam know. Lowther.
Madam Lowther. That's a new one for us.
Well, you know, whatever floats your boat. You know, I'm okay with it.
You cannot offend me.
So today we've got an interesting topic because a few things have happened here lately. So for sort of an overarching theme. Is, you know, this idea of, you know, do we take our doctrine seriously and do we take the Russians' doctrine seriously and strategic messaging, you know, because it was just announced that Vladimir Putin has signed Russia's new nuclear doctrine, which lowers the threshold for the Russian employment of nuclear weapons. And then, you know, about a week or so ago, there was an unclassified submission to Congress that was about a 6-page document that was an update to our guidance for employment. And, you know, so it was strategic messaging on our part, on the Russians' part. You know, it was our side, we're getting it out. You know, the Biden administration's getting it out before they leave office. You know, for Vladimir Putin, you know, this was an important change because President Biden, you know, sort of as a parting gift to the incoming Trump administration, gave the Ukrainians the ability to use ATACMs as deep as they can go into Russian territory. And of course, that made the Russians mad. And so we have this strategic messaging war going back and forth. And, you know, people are saying, can we take the Russians seriously? Can we not? Well, we've updated our employment guidance. What does that mean? So it's sort of a good topic to discuss this week. So let me, of course, I would go with you, Jim, as a career Army officer, you know, because ATACMs are an Army asset. So, you know, let me go ahead and go with you. So for the Russians and the employment of ATACMs, I mean, they're still a short range weapon. They're conventional, but they're accurate and useful. But they're not going to be, you know, and we don't have enough of them, and therefore we're not giving enough of them to the Ukrainians to win the war with them. But you know, they're not going to hit Moscow, St. Petersburg, anything like that. But they're still useful.
Yeah, they're accurate and they do extend the range. I mean, you think about artillery, you think about the ballistic, the artillery and even the rocket assist, the wraparounds that you have in an attack, them sort of just extend that out. This is basically extending the capability to, you know, reach to the back of the supply lines of personnel and equipment that's coming into the Ukraine. That certainly will help to relieve some of the pressure in Ukraine. But I'm not sure, at least in what I've seen, and I'm going to be curious. I'm going to really quickly turn this over to Curtis because I'm not sure how this changes the strategy that Russia has, other than to argue that here you go. Now you're attacking across outside of Ukraine. You're digging deep into Russia. You're threatening us from, you know, at a greater distance with the assistance of the United States. So what are we messaging to them, that we're willing to go into Russia? I thought that was sort of the red line issue that was laid out up front when we talked about, you know, NATO's power into Russia. And of course, we go the other way around, although, you know, it certainly was not followed by by Russians saying you cross the line in Ukraine, we're going to back up Ukraine. We sort of didn't do that up front. And now it's a little bit late because they've really extended themselves into Ukraine. And, you know, in terms of seizing ground from an army standpoint, once you have the ground and you've seized it, you gain the advantage at that point because you're there and you're on the ground and you've got to now be moved off of that ground. So that's the bigger issue. So if this is a war of attrition, maybe the ATACMS is going to attrit quicker, but there's a lot of Russia and, you know, in terms of size and number of people, and, you know, the addition of the North Koreans to help them out in terms of putting humans on the ground, you know, that becomes problematic. So I'm sure that's what that was a response to. Here's something that we can do because you've done something, and now it becomes a cat and mouse game, which will lead in, I think, to what Curtis is going to talk about from the nuclear standpoint, but maybe. Maybe I take you wrong. Curtis, you want to talk that piece first before we get back to the ATACMS?
Well, Jim, thanks. You know, I'm the ATACMS issue here that so recently President Biden has post-election has you know, sort of given authorization, and the White House is sort of hiding behind this. Well, they brought in the North Koreans argument, yep, right?
That's it.
And that's escalation. So we're going to allow the Ukrainians to escalate. But what we're doing is this is apples and oranges. You know, taking in, a couple thousand soldiers from a North Korean hermit kingdom I don't know, be added manpower and fodder.
But they've all been neutralized, Curtis, so they're really largely irrelevant.
If that's the case, then, you know, that's great. There may be more coming. It wouldn't surprise me. One of the articles we read, one of the articles I read, though, said that they were the best of the best of the North Korean army. There is no way KJU is going to send his best to go out there and be corrupted by Eastern or Western culture that is out there. Hear a podcast that we did a few weeks ago where we talk about the North Koreans going in and what they're going through with the Russians. But I would say,
But isn't that part of the strategic messaging? These are the best of the best. I mean,
it could well be, or it's just some reporter who's just, you know, mouthing something that he doesn't know. But I would just say this. I would say, though, that, you know, so what did we do? So we launched, we allowed the Ukrainians to launch a handful of ATACMS, you know, can't go any farther than 200 miles from their launch site, not necessarily across the border. So assuming they're already, 50, 60 miles into Ukraine, you've really, this is really just sort of long range artillery, speak. That's much easier to intercept. In fact, the Russians say that they shot down five of the six, and that the sixth was damaged in the fight. If that's true, then kind of what's the point? Millions of American tax dollars being shot out just to be shot down, and only to create an escalatory issue. I think what's interesting, though, is we do have some allies that aren't supportive of this. Both Hungary and Slovakia have come out very negatively against this authorization. And in fact, using some terms that we might be hearing here in the United States, like, hey, didn't you guys just have an election that said that we weren't going to do these things? That why would we be escalating now in the last 60 days of the Biden presidency? Why now does he feel that it's time to escalate this war? I mean, I understand why Putin escalated with the North Koreans. He needs manpower. But why now? Quite frankly, the Ukrainians were being quite successful with their homemade UAVs carrying bombs, flying them all the way to Moscow. That's might be a lot more effective than these ATACMS for the purposes that they need.
So since the subject is strategic messaging, and I want to get back to that because I think there's a different way you can look at this from a strategic standpoint. So I'm going to take a sort of different view because first of all, I do agree the ATACMS doesn't really add much to the fight right now. And we're starting to see that. I also will argue, and I don't know if you've seen in the news, that it looks like we're going to start putting anti-personnel mines out on the ground as well.
That's a controversial thing.
That's also another controversy, especially since for years the U.S. has been saying anti-personnel mines are, you know, are not to be used in warfare. And now we're sort of saying, well, okay, but in this instance, we need them. But let me walk it along a line that feeds back into the nuclear side. And that is that what if we are escalating right now so we can de-escalate in the near future when we change, you know, when we change administrations? What happens if the Trump administration comes in and said, I'll tell you what, you back yourself out and we'll take the attackums off the plate. We'll take the anti-personnel mines off the plate. Now we have some bargaining chip because we really don't have much of a bargaining chip going into this early on. So the messaging is I'll escalate if you escalate. I'll de-escalate if you want to de-escalate. Maybe playing a little bit of Putin's hand the way he does his nuclear weapons, where he wants to escalate and then de-escalate. I'm going to use my weapons against you. What do you think about that?
Well, can I throw water on that? Because that would mean that the Biden administration and the incoming Trump administration have a grand strategic plan that they're cooperating on. And I would be willing to bet a month's wages that they are not working together on a strategy for the, you know, for victory in Ukraine. They probably have very different views of what should happen in Ukraine. I'm pretty confident, you know, folks who don't think the United States should be heavily involved in Ukraine are now being more vocal because they see that, you know, they see the Trump administration is promising to bring that conflict to an end. And so therefore they're being more outspoken. So there's very clearly, you know, two different camps that are radically opposed to that. And I think you'll probably find people in the, you know, in the Trump administration who are not huge fans of, you know, sort of this unending war to grind down the Russians. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Biden administration has been, you know, more sort of pro fight them until the Russians give up, you know, and Bridge Colby has written extensively, don't worry about the Russians, you know, I'm paraphrasing, of course. Don't worry about them. The real fight is, you know, is China.
China.
And so don't expend your arsenal on the Russians. Save it for the, you know, and he for the Chinese. And he very well may be, you know, a senior official in the Trump administration. So that view, it matters.
Let me add to that. So there was a Gallup poll done of Ukrainians in Ukraine over the months of August through October. And they found that 52% of those polled favored a negotiated end as soon as possible, and only 38% favor continuing to fight until they win or achieve some sort of victory, however that might be defined. I think there's a lot of war fatigue on all sides of this.
Yes,
and so this is the challenge, and I think. I guess some of the irony of this is with Putin signing his new doctrine on ironically day 1000 of this conflict, is really meant to, I think, to sort of address, some of the issue of how do we get there and begin this de-escalation process. And I think there's a lot of folks out there who think that this new doctrine is meant to do the opposite. I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the problem with strategic messaging. So I want to sort of back up on a sort of more of a theory side. And that is that it's not clear, at least in what's been publicly addressed in strategic messaging. Because when I read this article and saw this doctrine, this could be really hawkish, or this could be what I always say with Putin is a head fake where, you know, he's using his nuclear weapons, which he uses them very strategically, but he also is very open to using his nuclear weapons to say, I'm going to get you to do something. And now what that something is not very clear from this doctrine, except that it does make us respond. And that's why I go back to my semi argument that the ATACMS and the anti-personnel mines are sort of response to this, to say, you want to escalate, we'll escalate. And now we both have the opportunity to de-escalate in some fashion. Now, whether you believe the Biden administration and the Trump administration are working collaboratively to bring about peace, or whether one twisted the arm or the other, I don't know. I'm not in those talks, but it certainly seems to be coordinated. I mean, these two things happen almost at the exact same time. This new policy comes out and wham, wham, those two things happen. Now, it's either a response or it's deliberate planning on behalf of somebody.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to think that Vladimir Putin has, it's a Russian way of war. The Russian way of war is coerce your adversary to play at a level that you think you can grind them down. And of course, that means, and for the Russians, we're in day 1000. That was not the plan. I mean, it was, maybe day 7, but it wasn't day 1000. So this hasn't gone the way the Russians want. Further American support in any form is problematic because it, it leads to day 1200 and 1300 and 1400. And eventually, the Russians will, have to capitulate probably before, if it's just a sheer contest of wills, we can probably outlast the Russians and us and the Europeans can. But that's what the Russians are trying to avoid, especially for the survival of Vladimir Putin.
But do you think maybe a result might be a negotiated settlement where Russia still retains ground in the Western Ukraine? I thought that was
a negotiated settlement for the Russians. For the Russians, that includes Ukraine not being any part of the European Union, never being part of NATO, giving up, Donbass and a couple of other places, mm-hmm. not paying to rebuild any of Ukraine, Vladimir Putin being removed from the, violators of human rights list. There's all of these things that would have to be part of this negotiated settlement. And you'll have to get the Russians, you'll have to get the Ukrainians, everybody to agree to it. And there are certain things I'm pretty sure that you just can't get agreement on.
So I agree,
especially with all the blood spilled now.
Yeah.
Well, that's terribly disappointing, as you've described it. I think we're talking about two states with Russia has a 4-to-1 population advantage. There's an entire generation of Ukrainian men wiped out. And, so I'm not sure that, they can outlast the Russians, in this sense. I think their only answer is a negotiated settlement. And, I think that there is, with that said, I think there's hope on both sides with the election. I think there's belief. I think Zelensky said in an interview that with President Trump being elected, he thought that the war would end sooner. Of course, Putin has immediately reached out after the election and said, I'm ready to talk. And so let's at least start that, because you know what? That is something that probably wasn't happening very well under the Biden administration and its leadership, in its support for this war. I think the American people are tired of it. That's why the election turned out the way it is. I just told you the poll, the Ukrainians are tired of it. My guess is the Russians are tired of it too, since they've lost upwards of maybe 600,000, casualties, is the rough order estimate.
That's probably high. I mean,
I heard a conversation today on some of these various shows, that when it's all said and done, the total casualty civilians and everything will be over 1 million. 30% of Ukraine is covered in landmines, and we're going to authorize more. So how do you recover and get into that? But I think this show should be not so much how we would solve the Ukrainian problem, because we don't have enough time left. But I think when we look at this nuclear question, with regard to this new doctrine, I'm very concerned about the reaction that I'm seeing with regard to this change or update, if you will, in this strategic clarity. And Adam, I'm interested in your thoughts, Jim, your thoughts on whether or not we should be taking Putin seriously in this new doctrine change.
He has both capability and will, and you plan for capability and will. I think, that's what you, and you have to plan for capability because will can change.
That's right.
And so Vladimir Putin definitely has the capability. He has the capability, you know, to employ nuclear weapons in ways that we'll scratch our head and go, was that a nuclear weapon? And we'll spend some time trying to figure it out. We'll eventually figure it out. And then Putin, you know, will lie and say, well, I didn't do it. That was the Ukrainians that did it. And it'll be muddied. So the idea that Vladimir Putin is, you know, he's not like the United States, right? So if you go back to Syria, where President Obama said, if you use chemical weapons, that's a red line, don't cross it. And then, you know, the Syrians crossed it and absolutely nothing happened. And then they crossed it again and nothing happened again. I don't think Vladimir Putin is like that. I think he understands the value of red lines better than American presidents have. And so he's probably going to be, you know, more willing to say, okay, red line crossed, therefore here's a response. But, you know, I read that doctrine. And the doctrine, there is wiggle room, so it's not a perfectly clear red line that's crossed. And as I read what it does say, I don't see anything that's happening like the ATACMS would cross that, you know, that threshold. So is nuclear weapons employment imminent? No, because that threshold hasn't been breached yet. But is that threshold a little lower than it was before? Sure. But that's what coercion is all about, right? Coercion is about pushing your adversary down, down, down. And the way you do that is you move your thresholds closer to your adversary. And that's what the Russians are doing.
Yeah. But I do think I agree that we need to take this doctrine seriously, but I also, we'll go back on and say what I've said before. It's sort of like torture. You know, torture is most valuable when it's threatened, not when it's actually applied. Once you start applying torture, then the information you get is whatever the person will tolerate and screaming to give you what you want. I see this doctrine as an elevation of threat. And I do think we need to take it seriously in terms of, you know, what could Russia do? But then we need to say, what is the way in which we can ratchet against this very clearly stated doctrinal issue of employment of nuclear weapons? And I'm not sure, you know, I looked at the report on the nuclear employment strategy for the United States, and it just recently came out. I think it came out on 7th of November, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, pretty much it didn't address really any of these new changes. My take, and maybe I missed something in here and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but mine was sort of like, well, you know, we've been talking about this stuff for a while. We're doing the same thing over and over again. Just doesn't seem we're taking it seriously. And that not taking a threat that's capable unseriously is a concern of mine, that we need to be able to address a threat and then reduce that threat by making a strategy that coerces our adversary into, as Curtis says, not taking an action. And that action is described in this doctrine. That's what really bothers me when I read these two together, because I'm not sure. You know, I think, you know, Putin is serious that he would apply this doctrine in the way that he says, but I'm not sure, and I'm probably different than the two of you, maybe not. I don't think he's like got his finger on the trigger going, I'm ready to go. I think he can be ready to go, but I don't think that's in his interest. That's where I see the difference.
Well, I think you're right. I don't think he's itching to press this red button, right? But I would say this, the strategic clarity in the doctrine is broad and bright. And I think that creates some strategic ambiguity of a different sort. I think what we're seeing in this doctrine is something that I would call, sort of a diplomatic redlining, which is a combination of escalation and warning. And so with this redlining, you're seeing these clear lines of behavioral expectation being drawn out here. And what we consistently see here on the American side is sort of this dismissive attitude that says, well, we've been seeing this and it's meaningless, rather than taking maybe a different tact and saying, despite all of the clarity that the Russians have been providing, they're still behaving rationally to whatever perceptive slights they're taking with regard to Western support in Ukraine. In fact, there was a note that was published from the White House that said, we're not surprised by Russia's announcement that it would update its nuclear doctrine. Russia had been signaling its intent to update this doctrine for weeks. We're observing no changes in their nuclear posture, and therefore we see no reason to adjust our own nuclear posture or doctrinal response in Russian statements due to Russian statements today. So the American perspective here is we're not going to acknowledge the changes, and therefore it never existed. what if we did react? That's what he's looking for. And that's not necessarily a negative thing. He's trying to see, where we are going to finally push back. Where is our red line in his behavior, so to speak? And when we consistently don't react, then his threats, his rhetoric, his doctrine will become more and more aggressive, because he'll think that, well, okay, it's not enough, so I'm going to keep going and being even more aggressive. What does it take for the Americans to say, ooh, maybe we need to put some bombers back on alert. Maybe we need to, float an extra boat out. Maybe we need to start considering uploading some of these missile systems. There's the other thing about the doctrine, I would say, and I ask our readers to do the research. It's all open source. You can read it all yourself. Is to come to the conclusion that they've read the Western playbook. They know what we're trying to do and how we're trying to do it. And so they're writing doctrine specifically to counter it with words first. It is a form of escalation. It is a form of warning. And therefore, it is issuing red lines. We can choose to dismiss that. But let me say this. If we expect our adversaries to respect declaratory policy that we put out with every presidential nuclear posture review or other nuclear doctrine, we probably ought to consider respecting theirs and take it for the amount of value that we would ask them to accept ours.
Hey, Curtis, I just want to add something here, maybe in a sort of a lighter way for my army brethren who are out there and remember the 1980s where the Russians said, don't worry about reading or fighting against the army doctrine because the United States soldier neither reads nor follows his own doctrine anyway. just thought it was rather interesting during those times. That was a statement by some Russian general.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So I'll the way I see it is, I see it a little differently than you, Jim, in the sense that Tom Schelling, wasn't it he who said, in Arms and Influence that, something about the best is the threat left in reserve. Mm-hmm. I'm paraphrasing.
It's the withheld threat. It is the withheld threat.
But I don't know what evidence do we have that that's true. I mean, the only time nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. have ever, we've used them once and they ended a war. And so this is the hard thing about understanding, the implications and, you know, relevance and all those things about nuclear weapons is we just don't have a lot of evidence to prove it either way. I mean, there's some historical evidence. We can go into archives and read the you know, internal presidential libraries and read the internal debates that were going on and what they said. We can do that kind of stuff. But the simple fact is that, you know, we've only used them once in the history of the world. They ended a war.
Twice.
And yeah, well, we used them Hiroshima, Nagasaki, but
there you go.
They won one war. They were used in one war and they won that war.
Yes. And I'll agree with that. But you know, what's interesting.
And so
though,
I don't know that Vladimir Putin is going to say, well, you know, Schelling says, you know, it's the threat held in reserve is the best one. And therefore let's hold this in reserve and we're going to dance around it. I mean, there's going to come a point in which he's going to, if this goes on long enough, he very well may have to employ nuclear weapons.
Well, absolutely. I'm sorry, Jim, I got to jump in here. Absolutely. Okay. And Russian and Chinese deterrence philosophies have a huge reliance on demonstration, right, as their means, rather than the withheld threat. What they want to show you is the demonstrated threat.
Serious I am.
Yes, look at how serious I am. And they'll do it in different ways, like invading a country or building islands or practicing blockading an island without actually firing a shot. But they will do things to demonstrate their ability to coordinate, integrate, to apply live fires and to show us that they know what they're doing and they're capable of engaging us at a high level. And so these are meant to warn, and that warning is itself a deterrent. That's the philosophy the East has. Right.
Yeah, but the other side is you could argue that it's meant to warn or it's meant to get you to react without having to fight. And you know, I go back on what I can't remember who said it, but the greatest paradox of nuclear weapons is that their awesome destructive power causes you not to want to use them. And we've seen that. I mean, you know,
but think about, put yourself in Vladimir Putin's shoes. Vladimir Putin,
I don't
said,
think I'd fit.
I don't know what size he wears, but I mean, he's like, wait a second, guys. So I invaded Ukraine in 2014 and took it from, you know, invaded Crimea in 2014 and took it from Ukraine. And you didn't listen. You just didn't listen. And yet you still kept talking to Ukraine about EU membership and about joining NATO, despite me taking Ukraine and reincorporating it into Russia. That wasn't enough. And then now I've fully invaded Ukraine. I shut down their power grid at one point through cyber attacks. I mean, what do you need me to do for you to take me seriously that I am not going to let NATO have any more border states that can roll into my three major cities in Russia, you know, that are a day's drive or less. I mean, he's been telling us that for you know, several decades, and now he's, you know, he gave us the warning in 2014, and now he's really put his foot down. So the idea that, oh well, he's not serious about using the nukes if you know, on day 2000, I don't buy that.
I would say the opposite, that he's, you know, he's given the warnings and we've reacted in the way that he wanted and he did what he wanted. And we've continued to, every time he says, I might use nukes, we tend to back out and kowtow to, you know, whatever. We're so afraid of that line crossing. He who takes that first action, in any of these conflicts, and again, we have never threatened, if you do this, we're going to nuke you. Except I think it was, I don't know, I think it was Reagan who just made that veiled threat of something about trading Moscow for Los Angeles or some craziness.
Well, we made a veiled threat in the Gulf War 91. But I would say that, to Saddam, as long as this war continues, every day is a potential day for a demonstration, right? And so if we want to de-escalate the opportunity to reduce the chances that Putin will actually trigger a detonation, negotiate an end to this war sooner rather than later. That's one way to solve this problem, right? So if you don't want to fight a war, don't fight a war. And I would say that the whole purpose of coercive deterrence, which is what the Eastern nations do, for lack of a better description, is to get in and influence us not to do things. The fact that we are not doing that is a tribute to the success of deterrence in the way that they wield it. And it is up to us. We are choosing not to do that. And rightly or wrongly, that's a different debate. But I would say that we're doing it less. I mean, the ATACMS order is just an example here. After 1,000 days, right, we're going to be coerced just a little bit less. And what is the alternative? There's a large portion of this world that is nervous that World War III is a little bit closer because we made that decision not to take a step back, not to be coerced as much as we used to be. You know, we were coerced, remember, for a full year, no MiGs, no jet fighters. Yep. Then we let them have those, no tanks. And we let them have those. And then it was, I need more artillery. So we give them cluster bombs. And so there's a lot of things have continued to roll here. And the only things where we have drawn the line is that we're not letting them use, you know, weapons of mass destruction in any way, and we're not committing American troops. And so there is apparently a limit to our commitment to the sovereignty of Ukraine. I'm not challenging that in any way. I'm just saying, just stating that for a fact. And deterrence, all I'm saying is deterrence works, whether it's against you or for you. And it is being proven every day that after the initial failure in February of 2022, deterrence held and it continues to hold today. And the question will be is in the next war, if that is in or around the Indo-Pacific or not, are we going to allow that first deterrence failure to happen or not? What lessons learned will we have? And I fear, Jim, that we haven't gotten those lessons learned yet.
Yep. No, yeah. I agree. We got ourselves into the situation. I'll just remind you, my philosophy is get ugly early. You can always back off later, and we're doing the opposite. So anyway,
okay.
About getting ugly early, I got to turn it back over to Adam because we're about out of time.
We are out of time. You know, that's the unfortunate thing. Now on our future show called that, I think maybe Curtis and I will be doing called Scotch and Strategy, where I think it's going to be similar to what's that TV show, Drunk History, you know, maybe it'll be like that, but, that'll last 2 or 3 hours for sure. So
for sure.
And that'll be on, you know, one of those podcasting websites or something, you know?
Everything we do is on the podcasting website.
Well, no, I'm talking about like Rumble or one where you can do TV show type stuff. Right. We'll have to figure something out
We'll live stream and see how drunk
we can get. That's what we'll do. Yeah. But only with the good stuff. So, all right. Well, it's been another interesting conversation. And so, of course, thanks to you, Curtis and Jim, and, you know, thanks to you, the listeners. Hopefully, if nothing else, you've taken your fine scotch and thrown it up against the wall, or you've said, man, I got to drink it all because I can't listen to these guys anymore. And but hopefully you were at least a little bit entertained. And if you want to continue to be entertained, make sure you read our articles on Global Security Review or Curtis's ramblings, I mean, musings on X.
Take it easy there, madam.
So just pay attention, right? Continue to read other people. Just know that when you read others, they're not as good as we are, but you know, bless their hearts, they're trying. So
and don't forget, tell other people about us. If you think we're interesting or uninteresting, let other people, you know, tell other people to listen in.
That's right. Train wrecks are interesting to look at as well, right?
They are, right? That's why people like to slow down for traffic accidents. Maybe that's our strategy. So, of course, thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us. And as always, we want to remind you to always think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.